This week, Hearing Voices from NPR revives a classic from 1978, produced by the late Carolyn Jensen Chadwick, the first of 2 hours, called The Courage to Create.
It's become one of my essential needs. I have to be making a film again. I have to.
The Canadian Broadcasting Corporation and National Public Radio present The Courage to Create.
At any given point when that's happening and you're getting an idea, I'm not really that much there, but I can count on it.
If you have a funny hat, people say, oh, how surrealist. Well, it's not that.
Now he drinks almost half a bottle of whiskey a day, and he's going to kill himself pretty soon. Now he knows it.
I love to feel spiritual when I'm dancing.
Autumn leaves, whether they're blazing in a tree or lying on the ground, are invariably colored with marvelous harmony. And it's this kind of harmony that I'd like to achieve in my own work.
Psychologist Rollo May is author of The Courage to Create.
It's to bring something new to birth. And that is the courage to venture into new realms, to bring new being into actuality. And this means a courage to look into, to experience your own unconscious, what Jung would call the archetypes in the unconscious, courage to experience your own being. Means the courage, obviously, to be different. I don't know whether a typical artist can help it or not, but I know to the extent he's an artist or a poet or a creative individual, this is the whole meaning of his life, and he doesn't want to help it.
First of all, I've been thinking about coming to the studio to write for about 5 days now. So it didn't start just when I came into the studio, right? It's been there and it's been growing.
Guitarist Larry Snitzler.
Something occurred that gave me the desire to compose, because I don't always want to compose either, okay? I found out that a man that I had visited with this summer, who made beautiful, beautiful guitars, died about a month after I spoke with him. His name is Ignacio Fleta. He was a Spaniard. He made beautiful instruments. I only visited with him twice in my life, and the last time, as I say, that I saw him was about 2 months ago. My wife and I spent a wonderful afternoon with he and his wife and his two sons. And that evening, after I'd heard the news, it occurred to me that I would like to write something for him sometime. There's this chance, maybe just this very chance. If nothing comes of it, nothing comes of it. I won't force it, and I'll just see what comes, if I'm ready to do something or no. And it might not be the moment to write an homage.
Larry Snitzler is a native of Washington, D.C. He studied with Segovia and Nadia Boulanger. Throughout this program, we'll listen to Larry Snitzler composing in the studio, transcribing his visions of Fleta onto the empty score sheet before him.
Most creativity in our world is blocked before it even gets to consciousness. I speak now of the run-of-the-mill human beings.
Dr. Rollo May.
The artists and the poets and the dramatists and the musicians are individuals who cannot block it before it reaches consciousness. And therefore, they have to bear the adventure, if you think of adventure as a risking one's sanity.
Your adolescence is not far from you, and I have a very sharp memory of the pains and needs and discoveries we go through when we are around 13, 14 years old.
Jeanne Moreau, the French film actress who worked with Orson Welles, Buñuel, and Truffaut, now writes, directs, and acts in her own films.
The surrounding in which one lives is very important. The atmosphere in the family, the relationship between your father and your mother. And though I had a very happy childhood, I was really aware of all the pains and sometimes violence which adults had to deal with. And my first essential attraction was reading. Reading everything I could read. And I wasn't allowed to go to see films, and I wasn't allowed to go to see plays. And one day with three friends of mine, three girls, we were studying Latin together. I lied to my parents, and I went to see a play. And that play was Phaedra, the tragedy de Racine. And there we were, the lights went out, and it started on the stage. And I was so taken away, so swept up my feet, and at the same time, so intimately related to what was going on the stage, that without having time to think, I felt the urgent desire to be in the light. I thought, I'm not going to spend my life in the shade. That's where I want to be. And not only because I want to be looked at, but I want to be able to give to people that magic, that powerful, that incredible, beautiful feeling that is related to all the problems of life, but at the same time, I want to be able to help people to surmount all the things they have to go through and maybe discover that many years ago, 100 years ago, somebody has been through the same thing as was written something beautiful. And that's why I became an actress.
Do you have to learn not to compromise that artistic ambition with anything?
I didn't have to learn. I never compromised. I never submitted. Because it's so deep in me. And what I want to give to people is so essential. So it has to be pure and true. So I cannot compromise.
I probably did some very important things at the age of 14 and 15 out of some kind of intuition. But I do not think until the last 5 years, in other words, since I was about 27, that my music had really any importance. I had no idea of the passions, the terrors, the visions, the abstractions, the metaphysics that this music dealt with. This quality and subtlety on every line. I was playing the piano as a pianist, which is a very poor thing to say of anyone, that all lines were sort of pianistic figurations. Rather than what a cello would, which every line would have to be bowed and every note thought out.
Loren Hollander was a child prodigy. By the age of 15, he was internationally acclaimed for his virtuosity. Now, he says, the vision grows within. The technique is an aid, not a substitute, for the imagination.
One can learn the craft, but the years of the 20s were such mind-bogglers in the degree of awareness and how one starts to grow that I cannot look very seriously at my early work. It was all very nice. It had a land and speed and excitement, which I imagine are important qualities. But the poet and the visionary and the seer and most of all the understander had not even dawned on my artistic work. And I now see that it requires a human being to understand this music and a knowledge of poetry, philosophy, and mathematics, and human relationships. How can you deal with emotions in music if you don't really know how human beings relate? The understanding of emotions. Yes, I read Dostoevsky, I read Tolstoy, I read Dickens, I read Freud, I read all sorts of things talking about these emotions, and I had quite a repertoire of emotions. But only then did I start seeing where these more subtle emotions come in, you can have a theme. Let's take the theme of the Tchaikovsky concerto, right? Now, this theme can be played with incredible passion. But its place in the piece as an opening, and you're coming with the pizzicato, and where this piece is going and why it is going, that one has to hold in what one sees is possible in a theme, that I now have to see my position in the concerto, where it is coming from, where it is going, and the type of emotion of holding in what is possible. How one would start this movement. I get the joy from the inner voices. I get the joy of following into this harmony rather than what I might have done, which is a tortured and maybe seemingly whatever it would be, which would destroy a larger picture.
I guess and I shoot. I don't take pictures. It's a picture that has to take me. Something jumps at me and I have to react very quickly. You look at reality just like you look at a sculpture. This angle, that angle, you evaluate. If you can, if a film is still going on, you look at the other possibilities, the geometry from another place, the expression at another second. You see, you have to be very fast and move very quickly.
Henri Cartier-Bresson, though revered and honored as the father of 35mm composition, Cartier-Bresson insists he's not a photographer.
I'm not a photographer. I don't know what I am. I'm trying to define myself, but that's not my my purpose to define myself. It's in relation to the world. As I told you, there's no good and bad. There's no beautiful and ugly in itself. It's always in relation to something. If some of my work has an interest, it's because it can be an evocation. It's a shout for me. It's, and that's all. I have no message. And it is a question, what is it all about? It's putting a question. And in photography, you put the question and then you get the answer in the same fraction of a second. That's why I'm not interested in photography per se. Utterly uninterested. I adore, and I always will adore, catching a picture. Of being overwhelmed by a scene and drawing it with that instant medium. I'm searching and going forward. One is, I started that way, painting, and now drawing. I thought I couldn't draw, and photography, which is a mean of drawing. I've done also movies, with Jean Renoir, but I knew I wouldn't be a director of imaginary films because the photography in movies, whatever movies, is always the next picture. You never see it. Whereas a drawing, a painting, a photograph, you see it, it's there, you can look at it as long as you like until you're bored. But now I'm drawing quite a lot. I still take photographs, but I'm drawing quite a lot, and I have problems because I'm a bunch of nerves and it's a great help for me in photography, in the type of photography I'm interested in. Whereas drawings, you have to discipline yourself. You have to keep a temperament, but at the same time, you mustn't. You must take time. Photography is a fight with time, so you have to be always on the lookout and ready to jump as a tiger. Not to kill, but to grasp.
That is the challenge, isn't it?
It is a challenge, and the challenge in drawing and in painting is entirely different. It's the intuition. It comes out like this. You don't know why. It's a way of living. It's putting myself in question.
Is it putting your work in question from the last... all your work?
No, everything. My work, it's myself. It's putting myself in question, trying to go further, and instead of a long playing record of the same old famous pictures, hell with it. Thank you.
When I first saw the cathedral when I was 14, I was overwhelmed by the splendor and mystery of a great Gothic church. It was the first one I'd ever seen. After a couple of visits, I began to notice its windows. This idea of colored light in such a setting so sparked my enthusiasm that I went immediately to the library and read everything I could find on stained glass, and almost at once began making sketches and designs for stained glass windows.
That encounter with the medieval mystique alive in Washington's National Cathedral led Rowan LeCompte back years later to create what has been called one of the masterpieces of Christendom, the cathedral's West Rose Window.
I was thinking about Genesis, where God said, "Let there be light," as the beginning of creation. I was also thinking about the start of the Gospel according to John, where it says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God." And I was also thinking about the more recent views of the beginning of our universe, where there was an explosion of light and energy, and I've symbolized this with the spark of brightness in the center of the deep toned sections of my rose. I would wish the figures in my windows to have a warmth and a tenderness that I have experienced in my life from people. Whatever is in the artist comes out in the work. It cannot but be so. The work is the product of the thought and the spirit, the feelings of the artist. A message, a feeling, an emotion arrives unbidden. I can't tell when it's coming, but if I'm wise, I'll always wait for it. And it generally comes to me when I'm listening to the sound of running water. Most often, therefore, in the bathroom when I'm washing my hands or taking a shower. Streams don't speak to me in that way, but water out of a tap always does.
An idea maybe will go through several sections. The voice will express itself through that color rather than saying, well, here I want to use a slightly darker color, a warmer color. It comes much more from the intention and coming as close as one can to that intention.
Best intentions of the interpretive artist, voiced by American mezzo-soprano Friederike von Stade. She sings, quote, "to give the audience a musical and dramatic charge." Few voices have carried so far, so fast, from the Metropolitan Opera House in New York to the Paris Opera and La Scala.
I think our job as artists, basically, is to deliver something that is not ours. I mean, obviously it is through our medium, it is through one's voice. But it is not our music, it's somebody else's music, Mr. Mahler, Mr. Mozart. And it is what they were intending, the purpose is to try and find as close as one can, obviously, because one only has one's own equipment, so to speak. And I mean by that heart, soul, as well as voice. Through the medium of what one has at one's disposal, to try and show a public what Mahler meant. If he meant to make them understand longing, sorrow, happiness, disappointment, to show, to make them feel whatever it is that Mahler was feeling through the music. And that's basically the responsibility of an artist.
What is the ultimate creative act then for the singer? Is it found in that discipline that you get your release?
That is what makes singing an art. Otherwise, it's a physical manifestation or a physical expression. There is rhyme and reason to trills and coloratura and long sustained phrases beyond that of technical prowess. So the art of singing is the use of extreme technical knowledge, you know, very difficult technical feats, to show something quite simple, like a very simple human emotion. Joy, sorrow, all the human emotions. It is the expression of the soul through the body.
Have you asked your voice everything you're going to?
No, I have a long way to go. One is constantly, constantly, constantly a student in this profession. One's voice, the more you try to push it into something that it isn't naturally, the more you're treading on something very, very delicate and very unsure and very untruthful. When you think what it is, it's these two rather thin membranes in the back of one's throat, and you're asking it through basically involuntary muscles. I mean, a very delicate coordination to perform essentially unnatural feats. I don't mean that singing is unnatural, it is natural, but what one demands in the realm of classical song and opera is a feat. It's a feat of strength. It's like one does have feet, but they weren't necessarily meant to stand on the point of them. And it's amazing, really, what one can ask of one's voice, one's body.
Coming up, we continue with The Courage to Create. Interviews with artists, including flautist Jean-Pierre Rampal and guitarist Leo Kottke. That's in a minute on Hearing Voices. We're back with Hearing Voices and the 1978 NPR-CBC special, The Courage to Create.
When they say, oh my goodness, well, here is the new Callas, or here is, you know, no voice is like Miss Callas, but Miss Callas, and what she brought to singing came out of her soul, and her voice came out of her soul and her expression. Now, one is a fool not to listen to it and learn from it, but to try and imitate it or be what she was, one will miss the truth of one's own self. To a certain extent, even with the faults. It takes a lot of time to be an artist. It takes an enormous amount of devotion.
The physical characteristics of the person one is in the creative act are complete absorption, confidence, a kind of courage that I think goes with all artists and poets. I think it's afterwards and before that they get worried about it. But while they're doing it, what I notice is an absorption in the creative process that requires a degree of confidence and goes along with the degree of confidence. Now we are forming new worlds. Now we are like the myth of Genesis in the Old Testament, where God separates the water from the land, and when we draw a line across our canvas, we are there separating one side from the other. Now, these are tremendous emotions.
It doesn't go very far. There was this... Nice, I like that, I like that. I have to think about that. Okay, now, something sweeter, slightly different. Yes, I like that. It's the rhythmic contrast. That is, you have a triplet. That is, you go 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1. Okay? So I can play even a series, repeat the same notes, and it still is very related to, because the rhythm is there. So I can vary those notes, keeping the same rhythm, and there'll still be unity, and yet enough variation so that it's not boring.
Larry Snitzler's compositions include works for guitar, string quartet, and a trio for guitar, oboe, and cello. This is no rehearsal or recital, but a composition in the making. Where do the chord and color schemes come from? Toronto painter Harold Town remembers the impulse that filled one blank canvas.
Yeah, I can pick one painting for which I have a absolutely complete memory of how it happened. I was reading the Auto da Fe of Don Carlos, and this is a complete description of the burning of heretics in Spain. And I read the book in one shot, because I can't sleep ever without reading, and usually get a couple of hours in, and I can't really ever go to sleep without looking at master paintings either. You know, I usually have a look at a Vermeer before I go to sleep. And I went to the studio next day, walking down the Rosedale Valley Road, which is out behind my house, got into the studio, and there was a big, fresh canvas there, and I started to work on it. I started in one corner with a strange shape, sort of like a newel post, and halfway through the picture I suddenly discovered I was painting the Auto da Fe of Don Carlos. I had the heretics with their great kind of conical paper hats and the figures, and Don Carlos, this pre-thalidomide monster, was up on a little box in the corner, And here was a painting that had been totally directed by what I'd read the night before.
What gets you to that point, the last lines you put on the paper? What pushes you on there?
First, to surprise yourself, and secondly, to do something that just hasn't been done before. And I think one thing that maybe most artists have is an incredible sense of time, because art is involved with time. It's a series of laminations. You make the first stroke on the canvas, the first mark, once you've made it, has a series of impositions possible to it. It has a series of directions possible to it, which are, unlimited, I suppose, if you ran them through some kind of computer. There's just no end to the number of places you could go from that line, but you have to make a decision which is going to be right for the vagary of your purpose. And I think most purpose is vague. I've just gone through a series of drawings of a toy horse, which I have up on the farm. And sometimes I start with the very back of the hawk on one leg, another time I start with the eye, another time I start with the tail. It doesn't matter where I start. And I just really hope to win. You know, I hope to get out of there with something that's not at all like any of the other. I've got 190 variations so far, to get out with one that's not like any of the others. And that will force me to a point where there is real danger in the work. I mean, the courage of the ultimate and definitive accomplishment of great draftsmanship is to take ever-increasing risks with the drawing. Now, no matter how nicely it started, you have to continue to risk it at any given moment. And the moment you set back from that principle of risk for even a second is the moment that the work dies. Not totally, maybe, not entirely, but it dies. There's an infinitesimal beginning there. There's the autumn is on the leaves of the work. You know, you can smell the decline.
Imagination lives in terms of the deeper forms. See, an artist would look at this couch and table, and he might see immediately how this couch and this table could be put in the form with those trees outside, and the whole thing conceived, say, as an abstract painting or any other kind. Now, most people don't do that. But the form that he sees doesn't come from the table and the couch and the trees outside. The form comes from him. And his seeing these objects in this particular relation to each other is a creative contribution. If you take Cézanne or Matisse or Van Gogh, he saw those in a relationship that other people had not seen. But when they are seen by other people, they help those people also to appreciate the deepness of being, if I may talk in those highfalutin terms. Other people see the deeper forms, the archetypes, that really speak out of the center of the universe. This, it seems to me, all creative people share. And it comes by way of the imagination, but is not something imagined. It's the imagination is simply a way of getting to a more profound level within oneself, one's own relationship to his own preconscious or subconscious.
Can you not feel your subconscious at work? It's a physical feeling, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can feel it all right. And one may get new ideas and new visions and new form. But this is the great value of solitude, because one then knows the best way he can deal with those, by and large, is in his own solitude, not in the company. If he gets the ideas, he probably puts them aside to remember till the next morning when he's alone at his desk.
As soon as I am in my studio, I could work well. I have to be in peace, but I could work by memory. That helps a lot, you know. And I could concentrate with my writing stuff for months and then be able to write it just right, as if it would be dictated to me. So that's an help.
Marie-Claire Blais was a strange, silent child who wrote incessantly at 9 years of age. The work is painful and violent. More than a dozen novels published in over a dozen languages, written first in the French of her native Quebec. She can look at someone for the first time and unfold a life story.
You see everything. Some writers take notes. I don't, but I write in my mind all the time. I see with my mind all the time. I love it because it is a necessity for me. I love it with passion. I love to write. I can't stop. And I think you would ask any writer, he would say the same. The great involvement you have with it. You feel lonely, but it is a reward. And it has some very positive aspects, really, that life doesn't give.
In the St. Lawrence Blues, you wrote that words seem to pick you up when you haven't anybody else.
So. That was the young man, Lemieux, who said so. Sure, I think for a person who is absolutely lonely, like him, words must be very important, like masters, like parents, like people, really. He was an orphan. He invented his own language. He bought a dictionary that was his precious gift. I got very attached to him because he was the naked person, absolutely naked.
What does he look like?
I don't know. I really don't know. You may meet him in St. Catherine Street or Peel Street. I always try to find where he is, but he must be around. I see so many souls with different bodies, and I am very touched by people, by human problems. I could be disturbed almost all the time by them. The problem of writing and the problem of living is something extremely heartbreaking for me, because you cannot separate the two. It's so difficult because it's always coming from your own life in one way or the other, like it was coming from the life of Proust or Stendhal or other writers. It's not like another heart in that sense that the musician is the interpret, or mostly another kind of artist. He's working with his soul, but less with his flesh. We are working with both, I think, and that's the danger of the situation.
One of Canada's most prolific novelists, Marie-Claire Blais. This is The Courage to Create, an oral exploration of the genesis of art. Perhaps the apprehension of beauty is a way to truth. The creative process has haunted psychologist and author Dr. Rollo May all his life. He continues to explore the mystery of the creative impulse with Tom Stewart.
Anxiety is a curse, a cross that we all have to bear to the extent that we do dare to go into our own preconscious or unconscious. It is an exceedingly difficult part of the creative act. And you can see why this would be, because to go into your unconscious is always very difficult. Now, at the same time, the artist is stimulated by it. If there was nobody to be against, I think he would be unhappy. He has to fight against his friends, actually, in the works of art. Friend has one form, he has another. These men are very good friends. One of them said to me, look, I have to attack, destroy what my friend so-and-so is doing. I said, I thought he was your friend. Oh, he is.
Everybody must think that he is the best one. If you find that you are always the last one, why you should play, you know? It's true or not? It's true. At the moment you are starting to play, you must think that you are the best. You have always in your mind that the others are very good too. Huh? And sometimes when they play, they are the best.
Jean-Pierre Rampal can afford to let others dream of catching up, for no one seriously challenges him. Monsieur Rampal brought the flute out of relative obscurity almost single-handedly with his interpretations, recordings, and discoveries of long-lost manuscripts. His joy is found in breathing naturally into the flute to create the sound of humanity itself. On stage, his sonorité is simple and pure, powered by an apparently unlimited supply of breath and the quest for perfection.
You
You are listening to Hearing Voices with the 1978 special, The Courage to Create.
I don't like to be an amateur on a certain field. I'm an amateur in the large sense of the word, because amateur means lover. I'm still an amateur for music, because I think that you have to love music. It's not a business.
What would happen to you if you didn't have music, do you suppose?
Nothing else than to have music. I cannot sing anything but music for me, really. Before I was painting, because I had to do something with art. Because I was not allowed to study music, then I had to do something. I was designing, you know, dessin. And the day my father agreed to, I said, okay. Then I left the painting immediately, from the night to the morning, you know. From the evening to the next morning, it was finished.
Never again?
Never again. It's very curious. I cannot understand why, still now. I cannot understand. Because I was living only for that, painting all the time.
How does it feel when you put that flute to your lips? I mean, I saw you play Sentimental. You were playing differently. And
it's true. It's true. You let you dream, you know, to nice things, you know.
What were you dreaming about?
Well, I don't know, you know. It was just like that. You know, you dream to all sorts of things, you know, nice, you know, nice girls. Why not? Sometimes, yeah. Why not?
You forget you're playing.
Well, I try to forget. I don't forget all the time, unfortunately. And when I forget it, I'm happy. But it's very rare to forget completely. But I try to forget. But we were talking about that with Isaac Stern, and he said the same thing, you know. One time I was in the public and he was playing a Mozart concerto. And I went back and I said, Isaac, it was fantastic. He said, yeah. And I said, I didn't see the violin anymore. When you were playing, I didn't see the violin. It disappeared, the instrument. And he said, it's okay, you are right, because I didn't feel it anymore. I think it's very, very important.
Let's say it's a heightened moment of intensity of experience that communicates the form in deeper levels of himself to the canvas or to the page on which the poem is printed. All these words make the poet indebted to millions of people who lived before him, all the way from 50,000 BC, when the caveman first grunted. But each person has to overcome his particular organic weakness, and now this means a kind of openness to anxiety. And the essentialness of it is not that he simply likes it, he doesn't like it any better than any of the rest of us, but rather that the new forms that come out of the unconscious, let me use that term to cover all of these levels, these forms bring with them an anxiety that Van Gogh experienced. Paul Klee, if you've read his journals, writes about it. Mondrian experiences it. Now, they live with anxiety. And it's both a cross and a stimulant and a possible guide.
I would sit down and tell myself the obvious, that I don't have many tunes outside of 4-4, 3-4, 6-8. So I'd try and do a real timey sort of tune with a lot of construction in it. And it would sound like somebody really trying to do a timey tune. And once I quit worrying about it, it all started happening again.
Check 1, 2. Turn off the house so I can hear what's going on here. 1, 2, 1, 2.
For some, Leo Kottke is the greatest acoustical folk guitarist alive. The Minnesota songwriter has attracted attention in tours of America and Europe. His style is unmistakable and unchanging. Offstage or on, his single 12-string guitar wraps around the audience with the depth and dynamics of a chamber ensemble.
I think everybody is playing the same tune, more or less. I think everybody gets their inspiration from the same place. And I think it's very likely that other people and what they've done along those lines have as much of an influence as anything else, no matter who you are.
You said everybody pretty well gets it from the same place. Do you have any idea where that comes from?
None at all.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Leo Kottke. Cloudy day, the sun won't shine, my blues away, and all I've lived for seems far away. Some cloudy day, hear the wind howl.
When it usually happens is when I've finished playing for the night, gone back to my room, and I'm sitting there playing, which I generally do. Those are the best times. That's when you've played past all your routines and all your habits, and you've gotten your fill of just the guitar. So after a concert is when things really happen. But you can get a kind of seizure that something like 90% of the population gets. In the morning, they'll sit down and stare at a salt shaker for an eternity. You just go blank for a while. When I stumble on an idea while I'm playing, that's what happens to me. That's how I feel. I don't really notice anything for a while. And I get very single-minded. And it's the most fun of anything that I've ever done. And it keeps happening, you know, it keeps happening again and again, fortunately.
How many times do you figure you have connected? How many good songs have you written?
Several. A song called Bean Time, which is one of my favorites because it's a real guitar tune. A lot of guitar about it. My tunes ever get is when they happen all at once. And some of those tunes, like Roommate and Bean Time, happened all at once. It was just, I started at one end and let go at the other. The more time it takes to get to that point, the less finished they are, and the more evanescent they are. They get too elusive until they border on being a mistake.
Ever take over where the guitar just cannot say it?
Not yet. Lyrics is usually the last thing that appeals to me. Words are better off just spoken. I think that's musical enough.
guitarist Leo Kottke. The Courage to Create was produced by Tom Stewart and Carolyn Jensen Chadwick. Russ Germain was the narrator, Jim Anderson and Jan Roberts the technicians, and Digby Piers the executive producer. Tune in next week for the final hour of this 1978 NPR CBC special on Hearing Voices.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of soundimagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is hearingvoices.com.